This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. For Howard Fuller, civil rights has always meant access to power. So he sees a continuous thread in his career, first as a grassroots organizer, then as a black separatist leader, and later as a supporter of George W. Bush's education policies. Others have found his journey incongruous. In the 1960s, Howard Fuller fought the war on poverty in North Carolina through community organizing around issues like voter registration, neighborhood improvement. He also helped found the Malcolm X Liberation University in Durham. He's a former superintendent of Milwaukee Public School System who advocates for charter schools and supports tax-paid vouchers to help poor children attend private schools. He said he was too busy working to end poverty to answer charges that he sold out his principles as a Pan-Africanist and black power leader. But now he's written a book that he says will explain who he is and how he got here. The book is entitled No Struggle, No Progress. Going to be reading from the book tonight at Quail Ridge Books and Music in Raleigh at 7:30. But first, he's back with us. Howard Fuller, welcome back to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
It's so nice of you to have me. It's always a good thing to come back here and to be on your show. I really appreciate it.
It is a pleasure to have you. Take us back to those earliest days in Shreveport, Louisiana, growing up.
Yeah, one of the things I try to talk about in this book, and actually one of the reasons I wrote the book, was to honor my mother and my grandmother. And they're the two most important people in my life. And so in the beginning of the book, I talk about an incident with my grandmother in Shreveport, Louisiana. And this was in the 40s. So, you know, you have to sort of understand the context. And I tell a story about sitting on the back steps with my mother, and a policeman came by the house and said that a man had robbed someone and he was in our house. And my mother said, there's no one in the house. And for whatever reason, the policeman kicked her. And so they called my grandmother at work. And she came home and got her gun and went to the police station. So those are the, you know, that's the blood that runs in my veins, right, so to speak. Right.
But you also talk about running from police cars from that day forward.
Yeah, well, no, what happened was that we used to run up under the house when the police cars came. Yeah. And my grandmother saw me do that. And she told me, and actually gave me a whipping, which would be child abuse today, but that she better never see me run again from the police or anybody else for that matter. So.
And education was very important, and it came at great expense to your family, but they saw to it that you got a good one.
Yeah, you know, I really don't think the kind of collective value system that existed back then, and I'm not sure it's still prevalent in our community today as it was, but my mother and my grandmother made great sacrifices to make sure that, you know, I got an education. And there never was a question about whether or not I was going to go to college. I often tell people that, you know, like I was a grown person before I realized there was such a word as why. Because like my little grandson, the other day I told him to do something and he asked me why. I never knew you could ask why. So, you know, when they said you're going to get an education, I mean, that was it.
Though clearly you came from a family that also taught you to challenge authority at great risk.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, those lessons have stuck with me. And you know, like you said, I always find it intriguing, all of the different things that I've been called over my life. And, you know, I decided a long time ago that I would never let anybody put me in any particular box, and that all of people's issues with me, those are their issues. And because I'm clear on what I do and why I'm doing it, and that's what's allowed me to continue going all these years.
Let's thread some of that out for our audience. You really grew up in Milwaukee. Talk about when it came to you, when it finally, you decided that why was the critical question, and that was you were going to devote your life to the big why.
Yeah, you know, when I was growing up, I was fortunate that I was, you know, grew to be 6'4", and was able to play basketball and played on a great high school basketball team. But I always felt like there were friends of mine, the dudes on the playground who were as good as I was, actually much better, but never quite got the opportunity to do what I was able to do. Now, some of that was personal decisions that they made. Some of it were circumstances I don't think were under their control. But the whole time that I was growing up, there were black people in the community, because we were poor, who had more resources and lended me a hand, so that when I went on to college, I really felt deeply that it was important for me to come back and give something to the community in the ways that people gave something to me. And so it was a decision between social work and teaching. And so I actually majored in college in sociology and minored in secondary education, and ultimately decided to go into social work and went on to get my master's degree, which really allowed me ultimately to end up in Durham, North Carolina.
Talk about that and what brought you to North Carolina and the kind of work you were doing here.
Yeah, what's interesting is that I was working for the Urban League in Chicago, and I had two friends, Morris Cohen and Kwame McDonald, who had come to North Carolina to work for the North Carolina Fund, which we talked about the last time I was here, the 50th anniversary. And they were aware that after the war on poverty, Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty, and the Economic Opportunity Act was passed, it created a number of community action programs around the country. And one of them was Operation Breakthrough in Durham. And so a job was available to head up the Target Area A. They broke the city up into, well, it was the city and the county. There were two areas in the city, A, which was essentially the black community, B, over by where Few Gardens was, and also where there was a low-income white community, and then Bragtown out in the county. And so they wanted me to come and be the head of the neighborhood center in Target Area A. Ultimately, I became the head of all of the target areas, and got very involved in doing community organization. And a lot of the stuff that we did became quite controversial in North Carolina, because we were really pushing to get streets paved and houses fixed and to change other policies. I always felt like that they said there was a war on poverty, and I actually thought, Frank, that we were going to try to win it. You know what I mean? that the idea was to try to eliminate poverty, right? And an important part of that was empowering people to be able to stand up for themselves. But another part of it that people didn't realize is I changed a lot of the budgets to give poor people jobs, because I actually felt like, you know, whenever these programs exist, those of us with degrees would make all of the money and poor people would get nothing. And so my idea was, hey, you know, like, we need to make sure that people get jobs. And so we hired people from the neighborhoods to do work in Operation Breakthrough.
It seems to me your idea was to take seriously and execute what was the language of the legislation. And remember, the war on poverty was modeled on the North Carolina Fund. Lyndon Johnson makes a phone call and says, I understand you got a program there. I might be able to use it. What's revolutionary about it is precisely what you said. It's organizing people in their neighborhoods to demand the things that they should have had anyway: streets, streetlights, safe streets, plumbing, all that sort of thing, which as you say, was controversial.
Yeah, it was.
And it wasn't the controversy, it seems to me, and I want to ask you this, what was it about putting in those improvements or the fact that people could ask for them and actually have a voice for themselves? That seems to me the revolutionary part.
Yeah, it was the way that you had to make the demands. I mean, because the idea of community organizing is pretty simple, right? It is that you may not be able to do much as an individual, but if we come together as a collective and we begin to really exercise our democratic rights to demand of our elected officials that they protect people in the ways that they're supposed to. So the building inspector is supposed to come out and inspect buildings. And if the codes are not being met, he's supposed, or she, to tell the landlord, you got to fix these places, right? But as you know, it was ironic that one of the biggest slum lords in the city of Durham, Greenberg, was on the Operation Breakthrough board. So when I read the legislation and it said maximum feasible involvement of the poor, what that meant to me was poor people needed to be on that board instead of someone like Greenberg, who actually was making poor people's lives miserable. So, you know, when you start getting involved in that type of organizing, and, you know, there were marches and there were demonstrations, because people had to be able to exercise people power. They didn't have money to do all of the behind-the-scenes stuff. So they had to get in people's face, and that's what we tried to do.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because it does take some kind of organization. On your own, you can't do it. If you're a corporation, you can spend money to pay for advocates who can then go to the legislature or to city council, do your work for you. And you talk about some of the folks that you worked with, one who became the president of a mother's club, an organizer, who was then evicted. Joyce is then evicted from. So the kinds of struggle, in fact, I'll ask ask you to tell that story to illustrate what a struggle it is to exercise your democratic rights to be heard.
Yeah, I mean, Joyce just passed last year, and she was a warrior. I mean, and what happened is that we were trying to do some things in the projects, MacDougall Terrace, and I actually just went through MacDougall Terrace a couple of days ago because I've been here since last Thursday. And I have to say, Frank, as kind of a getting off a little bit, I was just taken back about how much worse MacDougall Terrace looks to me. It's almost like the kind of places that, in my opinion, need to be torn down, and really moderate and low-income housing needs to be built instead of these housing projects that that was the policy years and years ago. They really need to be torn down, and people need to be put in regular houses, you know, so that they can feel, you know, more like human beings in a lot of ways. But, you know, with Joyce, I mean, we were trying to get improvements in MacDougall Terrace, and they tried to evict her. And our organizing actually led to a change in U.S. policy having to do with housing projects, that you couldn't just evict people without giving them a reason. And that started in Durham, North Carolina, you know, with the organizing work that we did.
So tell us now to what I would consider the next phase in your career. Maybe you don't. But then a move to black separatism, to Pan-Africanism, and the development of the Martin Luther King Liberation or the Malcolm X Liberation School.
Yeah. What happened there was when the students from Duke took over the Allen Building, and ultimately they began to talk about the need to have an independent black educational institution, not just to ask for Afro-American studies programs at Duke, but we needed something more radical than that. And it's really that thought process that led to the creation of Malcolm X Liberation University. And in the beginning, it was just, you know, we were going to have black English instead of regular English and black history instead of history. But I got in contact with some people in D.C. and also Stokely Carmichael and Cleve Sellers. And they began to talk to me about this concept of Pan-Africanism, and that was that we are people of African descent, and that, you know, this is a history that goes back to Du Bois, you know, and the Pan-African Congresses and all of that. And so as I began to study it and understand it, it made a whole lot of sense to me. And then you got to remember that this was during a time period when we were struggling to identify our blackness in the most positive way. And so it went beyond just being black in America. We began to talk about our identity with Africa and changing names and embracing that heritage instead of, you know, being ashamed of it because of the Tarzan movies and all of this stuff that was going on. So, you know, we moved towards Pan-Africanism, and there was a debate within the university as to whether or not we should be training people to actually go back to Africa, or should we be training people to do work in the United States? And ultimately, that was one of the reasons why the university closed.
I'm talking with Howard Fuller about his new book, No Struggle, No Progress, today on The State of Things. Going to read tonight from Quill Ridge Books. So then the question is, and you talked about it, some of your critics who wonder how the man who spoke with Stokely Carmichael about creating that university would speak with George W. Bush about his about his education policy, supporter of charter schools and vouchers.
Yeah, you know what? I find it interesting that some of the things that people view as issues of principle, to me, are questions of strategy and tactics. So for some people, meeting with George Bush, who I actually like, incidentally, I mean, if you didn't deal with his policies or whatever, just as a person, I mean, you know, he's a nice dude. I mean, but for me, meeting with George Bush was not an issue of principle. It was a question of strategy and tactics. And Derrick Bell taught me a concept called interest convergence theory. And his concept was that if you're going to get change in this country, there are going to be times when your interests are going to converge with people whose interests are very different than yours for being at that same point. So he talked about, for example, how during the civil rights movement, one of the reasons black people were able to make progress was because of our own struggle, but also because at that point in time, we were trying to convince the rest of the world that democracy was a better form of government than communism. Hard to do that with Bull Connor sicking dogs on people. So at a certain point, they go to Bull and say, hey, man, you know, you can't do this because, I mean, people did it because they also didn't believe it was right. But also, we have a larger agenda here. So at a certain point in time, our interests converge. But because you don't have the same worldview, those interests are never going to be permanent. And so people like me do have very difficult places. Like, for example, I may be standing with someone who supports charter schools and supports vouchers, but they oppose health care. They're against the minimum wage. They don't want people to have decent housing. And I get where people say, hey, how can you be standing with those people when and the way I look at it is I'm going to stand with them on this issue and I'm going to oppose them on the other. I mean, that's just the way that I am.
Is there also an accountability issue when it comes to charter schools and vouchers to make sure that if you're going to spend public money on these institutions, that there is public transportation, that there are free and reduced price meals, so that otherwise we don't end up with public money supporting the new Jim Crow?
Yeah, I think that one of the evolutions that I've gone through as it relates to this, particularly as it pertains to vouchers, is that I moved from a point of talking about no, you know, state tests to supporting state tests because ultimately I just had to like realize that if tax money is going to be put into something, taxpayers have a right to know what it is that's happening. And then more important than that, that as a citizen, you know, even though I want parents to be able to choose, I know from my own experience that parents will choose schools for reasons that other than academics, which is okay. But at the same time, as taxpayers, should we be supporting institutions that are not giving kids a great education? And ultimately, you know, I had to come down with, no, we should not. Yeah. And so I've lost friends, you know, on that side because of, you know, that position.
Howard Fuller, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's really great to be here, and I thank you for having me.
Howard Fuller is a professor of education, founder and director of the Institute for Transformation of Learning at Marquette University, and now the author of No Struggle, No Progress, a memoir going to be at Quail Ridge Books and Music in Raleigh at 7:30. You can find out more about our program at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.